Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Good morning, everyone. It's my great pleasure to introduce this session on imaging of frontotemporal dementia. I'm Massimo Filippi, full professor of neurology, and frontotemporal dementia is a complex and heterogeneous condition, which is the most frequent dementia form after Alzheimer's disease in people younger than 65. So it's a pretty frequent condition associated to young people, relatively young people, and it is a very complex disease in which imaging is helping us to disentangle the different symptomatology and symptoms. I'm very pleased to have here today Professor Federica Agosta, who is professor at the University Vita Salute San Raffaele in Milano. She won an ERC on frontotemporal dementia, so she is one of the world's most known experts in this field. And we are keen to hear you, Federica, about, first of all, which are the implications of for neuroimaging in frontotemporal dementia, especially today that you have co-signed an important European intersocietal recommendations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Filippi. It's my pleasure to be here and to discuss this important topic. So let's start with the first question, so which is the role of neuroimaging in FTD. So basically, when the causal hypothesis in a patient with cognitive impairment or behavioral abnormalities is frontotemporal dementia, MRI is actually considered a first-line investigation. And the reason is that structural neuroimaging allows, first of all, to exclude other causes, such as the frontal meningioma or normal pressure hydrocephalus, allows the quantification of vascular changes that can involve the frontal regions. But most importantly, structural MRI is the tool to identify the cortical atrophy patterns. And based on the cortical atrophy patterns, we can think about frontotemporal dementia. Frontotemporal dementia, as you said, is an heterogeneous condition, including at least three major clinical phenotypes: the behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia and the two major variants of primary progressive aphasia. So in the most frequent phenotype, which is the behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, which is the most common subtype of FTD, MRI shows most frequently a predominant frontotemporal atrophy, typically with an important anterior to posterior gradient. Of course, hippocampal atrophy, so mesiotemporal atrophy, is also part of this MRI pattern, although less pronounced compared with Alzheimer's disease, and typically more asymmetric compared with Alzheimer's disease patients. What about primary progressive aphasia? MRI is very important in the diagnosis of the two variants of PPA, is recognized as a very important tool within the diagnostic criteria of primary progressive aphasia. In the non-fluent agrammatic variant of primary progressive aphasia, imaging shows an asymmetric atrophy, most prominent in the left hemisphere, involving the inferior frontal gyrus and the perisylvian perinsular regions. Again, the mesotemporal atrophy can be present, but as in behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, is more asymmetric and less pronounced compared with Alzheimer's disease. And finally, in the semantic variant of primary progressive aphasia, actually MRI is very clear, so we should see an important atrophy in the anterior part of the temporal lobe, involving the temporal pole on the left side. Again, the hippocampus is part of the temporal lobe, so is an important part of the atrophic pattern, but again, most prominent in the left hemisphere. Just a very brief note on a less common phenotype of frontotemporal dementia, which is the right variant of FTD. which is a right variant of semantic dementia. So the temporal pole on the right side is involved, is in the fusiform gyrus is involved, associated with the prosopagnosia in these patients, less common, as I said, compared with the other. We should think also about the genetic variants of frontotemporal dementia. So there are at least three genes associated with FTD, mutations in C9orf72, TDP43 genes, and granulin genes. And pay attention in these patients, the atrophy patterns could be very different, involving not only the frontotemporal regions, but also the posterior regions of the brain.
Thank you very much. If I understood correctly, MRI is having a major role in the study of frontotemporal dementia, which was not the case only a few years ago. So perhaps this is a point that should be stressed again. And the other point is that you didn't mention PET, so which is another imaging technology that can be used. It is used in frontotemporal dementia, in dementia in general. So perhaps you might wish to add something about PET imaging in these different phenotypes of the disease on the one side, and then discuss which are the advantages and shortcomings of MRI and PET. And finally, if you wish, since this is a very recently described condition, the right temporal variant of frontotemporal dementia, if you wish to tell us something about how it is clinically, how it presents clinically. So several questions.
Thank you very much, Professor Filippi. The MRI, as I told you, is the tool that should be used in order to understand which is the anatomical involvement of the brain in patients with these cognitive and or behavioral abnormalities. But as you were suggesting, MRI lacks the ability to directly measure the metabolic changes associated with frontotemporal dementia, with the neurodegeneration in general, and also lacks the ability to provide us information regarding the molecular changes underlying frontotemporal dementia. So FDG PET can detect metabolic changes in the brain associated with frontotemporal dementia. And so, as also suggested by the last guidelines provided by different societies, including the European Academy of Neurology, FDG-PET should be used in the very early stage of the disease. So the major advantage of FDG-PET compared with structural MRI is that it is able to provide molecular and metabolic changes in the very early phase of frontotemporal dementia, even in the so-called preclinical phase in which the clinical abnormalities are very subtle, the structural anatomical changes are challenging to be recognized on a structural MRI. On the other end, the other major advantage of positron emission tomography using a very specific tracer is the ability to provide information about the molecular changes associated with neurodegeneration. We use very often amyloid PET and tau PET in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Unfortunately, we don't have any specific tracer for frontotemporal dementia, but we can use amyloid PET, actually we use amyloid PET and tau PET to exclude Alzheimer's disease, which is, of course, the most important cause of neurodegeneration, even in young people. Coming back to your question regarding the right variant of frontotemporal dementia, thank you for this comment. So the right variant, as I told you, is associated with the involvement of the right temporal lobe, with the right temporal lobe spreading to the right frontal regions. And so the involvement of the temporal and frontal regions on the right side is associated with a very challenging to be recognized clinical manifestation involving, for instance, the inability of the subject to recognize faces before more often than objects, which is something that is typically associated with the left variant of frontotemporal dementia. There are also some very subtle behavioral abnormalities, loss of empathy is quite often present in these patients. So the diagnosis of this variant is challenging compared with the other variants of frontotemporal dementia. There are now many groups that are trying to better define these patients from not only from a clinical point of view, but also from a neuroimaging point of view and using also other biomarkers.
Thank you very much, Federica. So we set up the stage for the present assessment of people with frontotemporal dementia. We might wish now to discuss a little bit in the closer and more distant future. And so point one is that you are an expert on this, as I said before, related to this mysterious terminology, which is called connectomics. So if you wish to tell us what connectomics is and how it can be used to study patients with frontotemporal dementia.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. You know that I'm very happy to answer your question regarding connectomics. So connectomics actually is based on the notion that our brain can be thought as a whole network, including different nodes, which are the regions of the brain that are ringed by edges, which are structure or functional connections between the different brain regions. And so based on quite sophisticated mathematical algorithms, we can reconstruct the brain as a network, so the human connectome, and we can try to model the involvement of brain regions, but also the spreading of pathology within the brain in different neurodegenerative conditions. And this is based on the notion that similar to other neurodegenerative conditions such as Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, also FTD can be conceptualized as a disconnection syndrome, which means that the appearance of clinical manifestations are the consequence not only of the involvement of specific brain regions, but also, and more importantly, related to the disruption of brain network connections between the different hubs of the brain. And so behavioral variant of TD, primary progressive aphasia, are all associated with a disruption of both local connections, so short-range connections, and global connections, such as longer-range connectivities. And so connectomics can be used to model these propagation of pathology. And for instance, we together, we show that this is the case in Alzheimer's disease, in Parkinson's disease, and most recently in frontotemporal dementia. So you can imagine that there is an epicenter associated with each of these clinical phenotypes, which is the region that is involved first by pathology, and that using connectomics, you can try to predict which are the major streets that pathology will follow within the brain of your patient during months and years. If this is the case, we have a powerful tool in our hands, not only to diagnose the disease very early, but also to try to track the progression, to predict the progression, and hopefully to try to test the efficacy of disease-modifying drugs very soon.
As we know, neurological conditions, especially dementia, starts much earlier than the clinical manifestations. So when we have clinical manifestations, we are already a bit late in the course of the disease. So assuming that in the future there will be treatment for frontotemporal dementia, we need to detect these people as early as possible, and in case that people would already have some sort of advanced tissue damage, what you are suggesting is important to design trials, for instance, to have a strong outcome in order to prevent spreading to already predefined areas from the epicenter of the disease. So I think this is very important. So moving ahead, and I mean, this is my last question because we are running ahead of time, is regarding which other techniques do you see in the horizon, in the future, which are likely to emerge as additional aspects to diagnose and monitor people with frontotemporal dementia using neuroimaging.
Thank you very much. So coming back to your last point regarding the early recognition of these pathologies, I think that both diffusion tensor imaging, RESIST, a functional MRI, if we are talking about MRI, already demonstrated the ability to capture the changes within the brain in subjects with frontotemporal pathology before the appearance of clinical manifestations. There are studies in members of family carrying gene mutations associated with frontotemporal dementia. So asymptomatic subjects carry mutations that are known to be associated with FTD pathology that already show very well a connectivity disruption within the major networks of the frontal and temporal regions. So first of all, diffusion tensor imaging and resting state fMRI. Coming back to positron emission tomography, as I told you before, we don't have now traces that can be used to demonstrate in vivo the frontotemporal dementia in the brain of our patients. But there are studies that are trying to define these tracers for tau associated with FTD, which is different from a pathological point of view compared with the tau associated with Alzheimer's disease, and the TDP43, which are known to be the two major pathologies associated with frontotemporal dementia. And let me just conclude adding some information regarding other possible important tracers associated with positron emission tomography. There are now emerging studies suggesting UCBJ as a tracer for synaptic failure. And if the aim, and for sure this is the aim of our clinical practice, if the aim is to recognize very early neurodegeneration, we know very well that in all neurodegenerative conditions, synaptic failure is something that appears very early, even before the proper neurodegenerative process. And there are now studies suggesting that using this tracer for synaptic failure can be useful. So these can be very early markers for neurodegeneration in frontotemporal dementia, but also in other neurodegenerative conditions. So we now are looking forward to see larger cohorts studied using this approach and to understand whether there are also some information that can be used early in the differential diagnosis between the different processes.
Thank you very much. I think that this was a very informative podcast. I learned a lot, so I hope it will be useful for all the Europeans colleagues that will follow it. So anything to add that you forgot, since we are talking about dementia? You said everything.
Thank you very much to you and to European Academy of Neurology for this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Very good. So I join to thank the European Academy of Neurology for this important opportunity, as well as the dementia panel that is recording four podcasts, one of which is this one, that I reiterate it might be very useful because Federica is an expert in the field on the one side, on the other we are talking about a disease which is very severe in relatively young people. So thank you very much and see you soon.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.